ever, or women. And God doesn't call us to passiveness. He calls us to engage. And when it comes to meekness, when it comes, we have a false understanding of it. When it comes to gentleness, we have a wrong understanding of it. So I would hope that we could leave today, we could go on today, and that you would be troubled by our cultural perspective of meekness and how we've been, throughout the New Testament, we're called to meekness as men. And we're called to gentleness. And we're called to the fruit of the Spirit being gentleness. What does that mean? You know, the way that we've interpreted it within the cultural church is that we're the nice guy. We're passive men that everybody likes and gets along and don't have any enemies. And so you're the nice guy that will make the elder. That would be very hard to, in the context of the Bible, that would be very, very hard to justify that understanding. Certainly right here, it would be very hard to understand it because he's talking about warfare. Okay? So we would want to be, I ask you, that is in a lot of New Testament, we might have a literal translation that translates the word in a certain way, but culturally we define words. And we need to define meekness and gentleness by what God's heart was, how the Bible defines him. So I would like to try to do that. Let me read the first part of 2 Corinthians 10, just as a contextual baseline for where we're at. This is Paul again, and remember that the second chapter of Corinthians was a second letter that he'd written, possibly a third, but a second letter for sure that he'd written them after he'd written a very strong first letter. Remember, we went through 1 Corinthians, and there was a lot of reproof and correction. So much so that I had a lot of people say, David, why did you go there? And very seldom do we even want to go through there as a church. There's all kinds of statements. Women are to remain silent in church. Women are to remain wear head coverings. Women are, we don't want to address those things. Let's just avoid them and say they're cultural and we don't deal with them doing. What did it mean? What do those things mean? You remember, there was a lot of, in our culture, there's a lot of controversy. I guarantee you, in Corinth, there was a lot of controversy. There was acceptance of sin. There was passivity towards sin in the body. And Paul made some very, very stern rebukes of the church in Corinth. 2 Corinthians was written to follow that up to a large degree. So here they are again. Paul's in that process. So that you need to understand that is his context in writing the second letter to the church of Corinth. Because obviously he offended people. Okay? He wrote, if you read 1 Corinthians, you'll realize that there's people that are offended. If you read it today, we will have a culture that is offended, a church that is offended. And until you understand what God's heart is, because this isn't, this was Paul being inspired by the Holy Spirit to express the heart of our Father, of a loving Father. Okay? We always need to remember that. This isn't a vengeful, chauvinistic, distant God. This is a compassionate, caring, loving Father that inspired Paul to write things down and to teach. So Paul wasn't doing anything wrong, and Paul wasn't chauvinistic, and Paul wasn't a confused, arrogant little Jewish guy. Paul was a divinely inspired, he might have been little and Jewish, I don't know, but he was divinely inspired by God to speak truth. Okay? So, now I, Paul, myself urge you, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you when absent, I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying, what are we destroying? What are these fortresses that are destroying? We're destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Okay? And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. Well, now that's a strong statement. You are looking at things outwardly. You are looking at things as they are outwardly. If anyone is confident in himself that he is Christ, let him consider this again within himself, says, just as he is Christ, so also are we. We can continue to read the rest of the chapter, and I'm sure we'll go, but I think that we will end up talking about spiritual warfare next week, too. And we will finish this out, hopefully throughout the week, as we often do on Thursday nights. Talk about where God has us in His Word. Never ceases to be amazing that it's relevant. The thing that I really want to focus on this morning is the meekness and gentleness of Christ. Okay? Our perspective of Jesus is everything. Okay? Our perspective of God determines who we are. Okay? And our perspective of Jesus determines our understanding of the gospel. Determines our understanding of God. Okay? Our perspective of Jesus needs to be correct. Needs to be right. And religion has done very, very little justice in that. In fact, it's done a tremendous amount of harm. We've talked about it a lot, and yet we tend to see the meekness and gentleness of Jesus as this pathetic expression in a picture on the wall of a she-man or something, you know, that doesn't look like the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and doesn't look like any man I want to serve and give my life up for. But Jesus is a macho, chauvinistic, studly man. This wasn't about his outward appearance. God was very careful in that Jesus, there's no images of Jesus. I mean, Jesus could have come in a day when there was cameras, you know, or something, right? But there was no images of Jesus. God purposely didn't leave us an image of Jesus. In fact, there was a fair amount of, I would almost say, cloaking that happened. Look at the road to Emmaus after his resurrection when he walked with the two guys. And he walked all the way, long trip. Okay? Miles that he walked alongside, and these guys didn't even recognize him. They didn't even know who they were walking, talking with. And I believe that there's a side of that Jesus was not, God purposely did not make him an imposing physical person. Okay? Like Saul. Remember in the Old Testament it talked about Saul being a head above all the other men. He was an imposing guy, you know, doing it. There was a figure that you remembered. God was very, very careful in the New Covenant to eliminate any idols, to eliminate any objects of worship, physical objects of worship. Eliminated the temple. Not only said it's no longer in the temple, it's no longer in the Holy of Holies. He tore the curtain in two that separated man from his presence, his Shekinah glory in the Holy of Holies, okay? And then, a few years later, he destroyed the whole temple. Not a stone was left on the other one. He allowed it to be, he allowed it to be destroyed completely. This is the only worship of God, the only, you might say, religion that has no, men want to try to do it. You know, we've got great cathedrals in Europe that are monuments to, not to God, pardon me, not to God. These are monuments to other things, men. There was a tremendous complexity of, they're giant old buildings built a long time ago that are still standing, craftsmen. That's what I have done in life. Build and work with my hands. Tremendous respect for the work that was done in those buildings. I really have a hard time with them. and struggle because God purposely eliminated buildings, things, images of Jesus, the tomb, the cross. We try to always do this. The Crusades were huge in trying to and they sent people from Europe and tried to find little pieces of the cross or this, and they brought them back and they heralded them. I mean, the whole Indiana Jones thing, you know, they're looking for the chalice, you know, looking for the cup. And you know, we as humans want to find these things to hold on to worship, to put central, something that we can be tangible in. And God is very much about not having that tangible. So it was the same thing with Jesus, the image of Jesus. Have it. So I'm not expressing that the outward appearance of Jesus isn't the issue. But the demeanor of Jesus is very, very, very important. Okay? Remember that we've read a lot in John, it says that if we truly love God, we will act like Jesus. Well, if we don't know what that, I mean, that doesn't mean that we're going to walk around in a robe out in the desert. Okay? Because that's probably not going to be the best way to replicate Jesus these days, you know. Maybe, but still, God's called me to do that these days. I don't need more sandals, so But what does it mean to imitate Jesus, to be like Jesus? If we don't understand the character and nature of Jesus, how do we know what the mark is? How do we know what we're heading towards? How do we know if we're keeping focused in the right direction? How do we keep ourselves so? The is wearing hair like him, or a robe like him, or a sandals like him, or hanging out in Galilee. That isn't the issue. The issue is the heart, the character, the demeanor of Jesus is what we're supposed to replicate and who we're supposed to replicate. So Jesus was meek. Jesus was gentle. What does that mean? That immediately conjures up. The words were interesting. Like I share with you guys, sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes the word studies are very revealing. Sometimes they're pretty literal and meaning just exactly how they're translated. But in Vine's Expository Dictionary, which I use quite a bit, it's a dictionary expository, expounds on the definitions of Greek words. Okay, it's a good tool. I would like to read a couple of definitions because they're important. The words that are used, I'm not sure that the current translation. Remember, we talked last week about there's a couple different forms or directions in translations. There's functional translation, okay, and then there's literal translation. And when they're New International Version being a functional translation. It's thought to interpret what the Bible said as directly as it could to how we would understand that. Okay? A literal translation is translating the words as directly as you can, even though they don't speak the same way we do. Even though they don't use the same phraseology or sentence structures or whatever. Okay? Both of them are valid. Okay? Let me just say, both of them, if done correctly, are valid. Both of them are going to the original, and we have some obviously very good early manuscript written stuff. And if as long as you're going there and using the predominance of the evidence that we have to interpret from, both of them can be valid. But they both have their difficulties in us understanding. One is that if a literal translation sometimes makes no sense in our culture, okay? And a functional translation sometimes is influenced by the person's perspective of God currently and culturally. And that's always a dangerous thing. But let's see if we can open this up. And again, if I did anything today, if anything happened, it would be to help us understand that we need a different understanding of meekness and gentleness. The word meekness, and excuse my Greek again, but is pratis. There's a couple words for meekness. And that is best probably defined, truly gentleness is probably the greatest word. And yet, so he says, I urge you by the gentleness and the gentleness of Christ. Well, that wouldn't make sense because he's repeating himself doing it. You know, so what does it mean then? Well, gentleness is actually different than what we understand. Epikeia, excuse me, is the word. But the word is rather than what we think about it being, it really means fairness. It means to be equitable. It has to do with equity and justice. But the two have a difference. Meekness in this case, okay? Meekness, let's understand, is talking about the inward state and the condition of his heart, of his spirit, of his soul, his stance. And gentleness is expressing, see you guys, thanks for being here. So, look forward to seeing you guys again, so. Okay. And gentleness is actually, would be the overt or outward relational word that was used for how he dealt with it. Okay? That's why they're both used. He's talking about the character and nature of Christ. He's talking about the way that that expresses in dealing with other people. Okay? And that's why I use the word meekness and gentleness. The word pratis is a... Let me just read from Vines here a minute. Sometimes this is a very good study tool. The meaning of pratis is not readily expressed in English. Okay? If you just try to follow me a minute, it's a little academic, but try to follow with me here. The meaning of pratis is not readily expressed in English. For the terms meekness that we translate pratis into, or mildness, commonly used, suggests weakness and, now here's a word, and I have a hard time even though reading it the last couple of days. It's pusillanimity. Okay? That's actually an English word. That's not a Greek word. Okay? It's an English word. I found it. I looked in my 100-year-old Webster dictionary and I said, what in the world? You know, why would they even use that word? I mean, I've never heard that word. I mean, I've heard words that sound like it. And it happens to be right next to it in the Webster's dictionary, you know. So, but the word, it says, the English, or the expressions, those suggest weakness and pusillanimity, okay? And pusillanimity means a lack of moral courage, okay? That's what it means. It means a lack of moral courage, okay? So, the English translation of pratis, okay, is that we use of meekness, of mildness. They suggest weakness and a lack of moral courage to a greater or lesser extent. Whereas pratis does nothing of the kind. Okay? The Greek word actually, contextually in the Bible particularly, because actually this word is a word that is, like a lot of words, has a very strong biblical definition. And it has a biblical definition that is actually a somewhat different or stronger bent in the direction than the cultural definition even did. Okay? But we need, and that's how we need to define this word, pratis. We just don't have a good English word to do it. It's not readily expressed in English, okay? Nevertheless, it is difficult to find a rendering less open to objection than meekness. Gentleness has been suggested, but as pratis describes a condition of mind and heart, and as gentleness is appropriate rather to actions, okay? There's the mind and heart, the inward part, and there's the outward expression, okay? It's appropriate rather to actions. This word is no better than that used in both English versions, okay? So meekness and gentleness are not good translations for us culturally, okay? So, for what this word is. It must be, this is a good, strong statement. Again, this is in the Bible, but this is a group of biblical scholars that seek to expound on what the Greek meanings are. It must be clearly understood, therefore, that the meekness manifested by the Lord and commanded to the believer is the fruit of power. Is the fruit of power. Okay? It is not the outward expression of timidity. Okay? Let's be careful. Meekness is talking about the condition of heart. Okay? It's talking about a state of being that Jesus had. But in Jesus, it was the fruit of power. Okay? It was the product. Meekness was the product of power. Now, hang with me here. The common assumption is that when a man is meek, it is because he cannot help himself. Okay? The common assumption is that when a man is meek, it is because he cannot help himself. But the Lord was meek because he had the infinite resources of God at his command. Okay? Described negatively, meekness is the opposite of self-assertiveness and self-interest. It is equanimity of spirit that is neither elated nor cast down simply because it is not occupied with self at all. So, the two words that we use to translate, because the Greek translation of them is there. In the New International Version, if anybody has that, the amazing thing, they use the same thing. And I'm thinking, well, why did these guys from Dallas Theological Seminary, or the preponderance of the conservative evangelicals that were in translating the New International Version, why did they use these same words if they don't really accurately describe what's there? The fear I have in that, is that, are they translating according to their perception of meekness and gentleness? Okay? Because, truthfully, and again, here we have a context of talking about weapons of warfare. Okay? And when you look at Jesus, we say he was meek and gentle. Oh, really? How long has it been since you've read the Gospels? How long has it been since you have looked at the way he addressed the Pharisees? Because it does not fit our impression of meek and gentle. Okay? He was bold. Okay? Absolutely confident. In fact, he was fierce. To the point of scorn, ridicule, time and time and time again, they tried to kill him. Even in his own town, remember? He went back to hang out and around the Sea of Galilee and went back to Nazareth, and here he is going in the temple, and they're going, wow, here's this dude. He's become a rabbi. I thought this guy used to live here. And at first they're going, see, he's from our town, man. There's something is good come from Nazareth. Remember, because everybody always says there's nothing good can come from Nazareth. You know? So he's going, wow, this is kind of cool. You know, look at all the people were going, this is cool. And Jesus spoke so boldly. In a short period of time, they were chasing him out of the temple, trying to stone him, throw him over a cliff and kill him. Because he was meek and gentle. We would not describe that as gentleness in our culture. When Jesus called them a brood of vipers, that was not, oh, you guys are kind of snakes. Okay? No, he just was strong in his statement towards them. Does that mean that he wasn't gentle? Does that mean that he wasn't meek? No. It means that our understanding of what we are called to, because we are called to gentleness and meekness, is wrongly understood. Okay? That is the difference. Jesus was extremely bold. Jesus' meekness, as described very aptly, was the fruit of power. There's a the application that I believe is appropriate. You know, in carrying a gun, and if you know me, I think any of you know me, know I'm really not paranoid, not really afraid, but rarely is there a gun very far from me. Okay? And you know, there's some in my car. I didn't bring one in today because I thought probably be all right, but who knows? Sometimes might, you know. So But this has nothing to do with fear. What the original, probably most famous handgun, which handguns typically are a great self-defense tool, I'm doing close-range self-defense tool, was called a peacemaker. Okay? Aptly named. It wasn't called a troublemaker. Now, did some troublemakers have peacemakers? Yes. Okay? It was a Colt 45, basically, built by the Colt Arms Company and Colt 45. You know very well. He has a few very nice ones in his collection. And Tom is soon to inherit. So Tom will be the new peacemaker, okay, doing it around time. I expect him to wear it to his church, you know, in his new leather holster there doing it. But why is it a peacemaker? I would say this. A few years ago, back when all the black gun stuff and the magazine stuff and assault weapon stuff came out, there was a bunch of true facts that came out. And there's the best, most definitive studies about crime and guns all point to the fact that more guns equal less crime. Okay? It's just a proven fact. It's not a speculation. It's more guns equal less crime. Okay? That's a proven fact. They figured there's over 300,000 a year major felonies avoided or averted because without anybody ever shooting anybody because of handguns. How does that happen? Demeanor. Okay? It has everything to do with demeanor. Okay? A peacemaker was not meant that I had to go around shooting people to keep peace. A peacemaker meant, no, you need to respect the rights of that person or there will be very strong consequences. Okay? That will happen. And it's not that you're bigger than me or that you're stronger than me or that you're quicker, faster. Well, the gun draw thing, we put a little too much emphasis on that in the West. But the effort is, and I found it in my own self, that usually conflict is avoided by demeanor. Okay? Quite often conflict is avoided. And what's that come from? Confidence. It comes from confidence. And peacemaker gave confidence. Okay? 45 is pretty big. It's almost half an inch. You know, it's a big old piece of lead, and you look down the barrel of that thing, and life seems really ugly, you know, or really serious right at the moment. Okay? And it was primarily as a peacekeeper and a peacemaker. Okay? And so we need to, this is a gun. In our culture, what do we think of peace? We think of a Volkswagen bus and, a sign and, yeah, peace, you know. A hippie going down the road smoking pot, you know, and this is peace, you know. Anti-war demonstrator with beads, you know, or something. And there was some of that that was valid. Pardon me, there was a lot that wasn't. Just like a lot of causes, there was a good excuse for drunkenness and drugness and hedonism. But, I'm not a Lyndon Johnson fan, but there was... Our expression and understanding of peace and being a peacemaker is very wrong, okay? According to the Bible, our idea of a peacemaker, no matter what the cost is, it's okay, you know, I'll make amends. It's okay, you know, let's just get along. That's all that matters. That is really the number one thing, is political correctness, getting along, right? That is really it. So that's causing peace. I want peace here. Peace means lack of conflict. That's not the case. Nation of warring. Okay? Weapons of warfare are divinely empowered for the destruction of fortresses. I mean, think about it for a minute. This is exciting to all boys. This is blowing stuff up. Okay? I mean, this is Tannerite, you know, in pounds. I don't know if you, us older guys would know. Tannerite's a new product they put out. I'm sure it's not new. I'm not exactly sure what the deal is. Have you heard of Tannerite? Sweet deal. Doesn't cause fire, supposedly, but it's amazing. You have to shoot it with a high velocity round, and it blows up big. Okay? And they've made it safe consumption. I mean, they sell it at Cabela's, you know. Like the coolest thing ever. All boys want to do it, you know. You know, my son had a basketball party over in Matthew last week, you know, and they took 20 pounds of Tannerite and stuck it underneath a water heater, you know, out there in an old cast iron water heater, and stuck hay bales all over the top of it so it would hold down and, you know, take the thing and blew the thing about 60 feet in the air, you know, when they find it, you know. Fun with Tannerite. There's a video out that is just the coolest thing ever. I don't even know. Carcass of a dead animal with Tannerite, and two coyotes came in to eat it, and they shot the carcass of the dead animal, and things got real Western. It was, coyotes were flying 30 feet in the air. And I know for those of you like dogs, that might not seem nice, but they're coyotes, okay? So they went down. So I like coyotes, but it's all right, they blow up too. But anyway, the weapon divinely inspired for the destruction of fortresses. We're talking power here. We're not talking about, the weapons of our warfare are being nice, or getting along, or not having conflict. No, they're divinely and powerful for the destruction of fortresses. Power under control. Steve used to talk about, remember he was into all that kung fu stuff, you know? Back into it over there in Oregon now. And the whole family's doing it. Linda and Steve, and I can just see it. So they're hippies, you know. But they're over there. And his, what was it? It's power under control is how in martial arts they describe meekness. I think that's probably pretty appropriate. That's probably much more appropriate than our cultural understanding of meekness. Power under control. It is not the lack of power. It is not the inability to defend or execute or do what needs to be done. Okay? It is power. Okay? And that's where it comes from. Jesus was not unable to do what he needed to do. Jesus functioned in the power of God. I mean, I don't know how many of you ever thought about the fact that when if I had the resource to call down the angels of heaven, and I was put through what Jesus said, that's why God probably doesn't give me that power, okay? Because it would not be pretty, and it would not go well. If it's the way Jesus was treated, the way that he was beaten, mocked, ridiculed, scorned, lied about, the way they mocked his father, the way they mocked God, in spite of the fact of what they thought they were doing. And let me tell you what, that was meekness. That was power under control. Meekness was Jesus putting himself on the cross. They did not take Jesus' life. Jesus willingly gave his life. That was meekness. Okay? That was him putting himself on the cross for us. That was him taking on the burden of sin. The guilt, the shame, that had to be the worst part. The one thing that Jesus apparently probably absolutely, okay, never experienced with separation from God until the cross. The physical pain was radical. We tend to think of the 39 lashings, and we tend to think of them beating a crown of thorns on his head, and we tend to think of all the things that he went through physically, which were huge. Of just the torturous is probably one of the most torturous deaths of the cross. And we tend to think of those things as real. Those are real, okay? But the most torturous thing that Jesus went through was separation from God because he took the sins of the world on himself. That for the first time in his life, Jesus was God. He says, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" He was just, that had to be the most devastating part of it. Is that for the first time, he was separated from God because of sin. Because he took the sin of man on himself. That had to be the biggest price he paid. Willing to take that because, and I am beginning as I get old and longer in my walk with God to understand that. The longer I go, the more I do not want anything to separate my relationship with God. There is a radical aversion to and unwillingness towards sin. Because I do not want broken fellowship with God. And that is what happens when we sin. Okay? Is there an advocate with the Father who has paid for our sin and the forgiveness of Jesus, is that available to us? That is available to us. But rebellion to God isn't just, oh well, sorry. Rebellion to God and disobedience to God brings broken fellowship. Period. And if you don't recognize the reality of it, it's probably because you exist in a state of broken fellowship with God. And so it doesn't seem abnormal. And that's tragic. And that's sad. But I know that because I spent most of my life in that state. Okay? I spent most of my life not knowing what intimate, unbroken fellowship with God was like. Like most people, I believe that you're just in bondage to sin as long as we're on this earth. Oh well, can't do anything about that. That's just the state we exist in. And that's a pathetic life in the pit of hell. Okay? That is not the intention of God in our relationship with Him. God intends that we walk in intimate relationship with Him. Okay? Unbroken fellowship. Can we? Yeah. What keeps that from happening? Our rebelliousness, our sin, our flesh. We have an advocate with the Father who can restore that relationship and bring forgiveness and lack of guilt again, lack of shame again that sin produces. And we can, in a sense, start over in that unbroken fellowship. What is God's intention? Unbroken fellowship. To live in holiness. To walk in intimate relationship with Him. In the power of the Holy Spirit, in the enlightenment of the Holy Spirit, that's God's intention for us. That's the gospel. That's the truth of the gospel. That's the sweetness of the gospel. Okay. So, you know, it's why it uses two different words, depending on your translation. Does any of you guys' Bible say anything besides when Paul says, "Myself urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you in absence." Does somebody else, when Paul says, "I am what?" That's one of the translations. Anybody else to say something different? And lowly in some ways is understandable, but it's just not a word we use, you know? I mean, I probably called you a lowlife. No, I haven't called you a lowlife doing it. But we don't understand lowly. Okay? It's not a word that we use. Okay? But it's probably somewhat apt because there's actually two different words, right? Because kempinos is actually the word that Paul uses to describe himself. Two different Greek words. Okay? The first one, he says, "I urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ." That meekness, again, is pratis. Okay? And the second meek that he uses, that "I am meek," is tempinos, okay? That's a different word. Okay? That's a completely different word, okay, than pratis. Most of the time, when we're called to, when Jesus describes himself, when Jesus, in the Beatitudes, which I was going to read, and I was reading through them again, you know, the word there is pratis, okay? Tampinos is a different word, and I know that probably sounds Italian or Mexican, not Greek, but excuse my enunciation here. So that word is actually different. The word actually means low-lying or lowly, okay, or humble. Okay, humble is probably our best understanding of that. But low-lying is actually the literal translation of the Greek word, okay, lying low, okay, on your face, whatever. Is in lowly is a valid translation of that meekness. Completely different word than the first word he used. Okay. And it's, again, it's important for us to understand what he's saying, because here we are reading these first words and he goes, "I, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, and I who am meek." And we tend to go, "I am meek. Is Paul being meek?" Okay. That is not what's being expressed here. Okay. So the word gentleness is very important. The word gentleness is not talking, you know, gentleness is not necessarily, is not the way that I touch my grandkids necessarily, the way that I pat them on the head or put my arm around them. Okay? That's not what the word means. Okay? The word when it's talking about, it's referring to justice, with being equitable, being fair, in the way that we deal with others. Okay? And that's what it's talking about, and that's what it's talking about Jesus. How Jesus dealt with other people in fairness, equitably. Okay? And so when he's talking about Protus and Epikeia, okay, what he's talking about, power under control, and he's talking about, and that's his inner being. That's a description of his soul. That's a description of his character. Okay? This is not from insecurity. This is not from lack of ability. This is not from timidity. Okay? This is because he is not self-expressing. This is because Jesus did not live for himself. That's why he didn't call down the legions of angels. Right? Satan tempted him with it. We tend to kind of mock or laugh at it or not pay attention to it. But in the most epic spiritual battle probably on the face of this earth, when Jesus went and spent 40 days to be tempted literally by the devil, okay, in the desert. And what did the devil tempt him with? Call down some angels. Right? Just call down some angels and turn these rocks into bread and do this and do that. And we tend to mock it and think of it, you know, that was the devil's A game. I mean, guarantee you, he knew what the motivation or the natural compulsion of a man would be. Okay? Because he deals with men. He'd been dealing with men for several thousand years, right? He knew the compulsion of men. And he knew that in the physical state that he was in, he knew that in the press, he knew the things that would motivate a man. You know? Call down these legions of angels, take care of you. You have that ability. You have that right, even. He was God. He was God incarnate on earth. I mean, he created this earth. He created the rocks. He created what holds them together. Okay? And Satan was realizing and knew that. Went, oh my. And so he appealed to him as a man, in his human nature. Just call down the angels and do that. Jesus didn't. He says, man does not live by bread alone. Right? He says, I don't tempt God. I am completely dependent on Him and realize that God will provide for me. That was meekness. Okay? That was meekness on Jesus' part. I don't know, I wouldn't have been so meek in that case. I would have been self-fleshly bold, exerting myself. But what was Jesus about? He says that I am not about doing my will. I'm about doing the will of my Father. And that is meekness. It's all the power of the universe at our disposal, which, doesn't the Bible say is true? Not exerting that for ourselves. Not calling that down, not calling that out for ourselves. Should we call it out? Yes. He says that we should call it out. He says that that's divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. Okay? Just like Jesus did. Just like Jesus did. Jesus was not a passive man. Jesus gave himself wholly and completely to God and to us, willingly. Okay? That was an active act, not a passive act. There was nothing timid about Jesus. And if you read the Gospels, and I would challenge you to do this, it's one of the reasons why, let me just say this, and I ask you to read the Gospel. Please do. Please, please do. It's one of the reasons we avoid the Gospels. Because we read Jesus assaulting people, and we have a really hard time with it. Because he's not very kind and gentle. He doesn't seem kind and gentle and meek at all. I mean, he is in people's face. In the Gospels. And we have a very hard time with that because that goes against our understanding of Jesus. Okay? That's not a peacemaker. That's not gentle. That's not kind. I mean, he really offended him. I mean, offended people, we're not talking about they were mad at him. We're talking about they wanted to kill him. They tried to kill him. They were offended, highly offended, okay? With boldness, he talked. And we are, Paul says, okay? He talks about, I ask that when I am present, I may not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. Okay? I, who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you when absent. I believe that the expression in there, in my Bible, there's an exclamation mark at the end of that sentence. And it's giving the contextual strength of expression. It's to me in that statement that Paul is responding to criticism. That Paul is responding to statements that people had made. You know? You're really kind of pathetic when you're around. You know, you seem like this short little Jewish guy, and I'm just extrapolating. I'm not trying to mock Paul or God here, but that's kind of the impression we have, you know, kind of a half-blind, sawed-off little Jewish guy or something, you know, that doesn't speak very well or something, right? And again, I'm not mocking Paul. Paul was a man used greatly by God. But there seems to be this expression in what they're saying to him, oh, you act big in your letters, but when you're face-to-face, okay? And this seems to be Paul's rebuttal to him. I, who am meek when face-to-face with you, but bold towards you when absent. Now, what Paul is saying is, that's not true. You may think that's true, but that's not true. Okay? It's kind of like Jesus. Remember when they accused him and accused him and accused him? Remember when Caiaphas was, when he was brought to trial right before his crucifixion and they were accusing him? Time and time again, he was brought before and they said, what is this? And he didn't respond. Okay? Oftentimes didn't respond. Sometimes he responded real directly. And usually it didn't go real well. Okay? Because I don't remember Jesus ever saying, I'm sorry. Now, we as humans, we sin. We're not perfect. We need to say we're sorry. Okay? That's probably, assuredly, going to be a necessary statement in our vocabulary. Okay? Jesus, it wasn't. And he didn't apologize. He never apologized for offending. He never apologized for stirring up riot and people to anger because he didn't do anything wrong in their midst, among people. He never sinned. He never responded wrongly. He never responded with over-enthusiasm. He never responded wrongly. The reactions of people will tell you when you read the Gospels. So I would ask you to read the Gospels, please, and read about Jesus and be troubled by it, okay? Because I pretty much guarantee you that if you read the Gospels, you will be troubled by it, okay? Because this Jesus doesn't fit our description and understanding of Jesus. The what we call the meek, the gentle, the kind. The little guy that's just got his hands on the children and is just a nice guy and never responds, never fights, and is always just a nice guy. Really? You will see a guy in the gospel that flat gets in people's faces. Okay? Why? Because he didn't love, because he was angry, because he was exuding his flesh? No. No. There's a good friend of mine that is struggling in his walk with God and trying to understand how to be a light to his family. And my admonition to him, and my admonition to all of us as men, I guess, and something that God really laid on my heart is not Teddy Roosevelt's comment of walk softly and carry a big stick, but I believe that the biblical rendition of that would be to speak boldly, but live humbly. Okay? That's what we are as men to be. Humbly meaning not promoting myself, not living for myself, not exuding self, period. That is not about me. My call and your call is to live for others. It's to lay your life down for each other. Okay? That's your call. Not to promote yourself, not to live for yourself, not to direct things toward yourself. To the degree that the world revolves around us is the degree of our degeneracy and our rebellion towards God. Okay? The world does not revolve around us. Okay? We are to lay our lives down as Jesus laid his life down for people. But the truth is true. And we are told that we are given the Spirit of truth if we're born again. God, in the form of the Holy Spirit, lives in us, directing, teaching, admonishing, correcting, speaking through. Okay? That is boldness. That is speaking truth by the power of God. And we are to speak truth by the power of God. Obviously, God set very strongly, the foundation for that has to be what? Love. Right? If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, if I have all wisdom and all knowledge, and all faith, so as to say to that mountain, move. And it moves. But I don't have love, I'm nothing. I'm a sounding gong or a clanging cymbal. All I will do is this profound truth of God will do nothing but irritate. What does it mean, love? Again, there we have a very big problem with wrong definition. That's being nice, right? Liking people a lot and being nice. No, that's not what it says. Love, agape love, means if you do not care about others more than yourself, if you are not laying your life down for them, shut your mouth. That's the short version. That's what it says. Okay? The baseline is love. The baseline is we are to care about others more than ourselves. This is not about self-exertion. And it's not about just because truth is truth. I have no right. In fact, I will cause more damage if I speak truth just for the purpose of speaking truth. Okay? Truth, just because it's truth, is not a positive effect. Let me just guarantee you, we live in a world full of truth. We live in a world that reflects God. Okay? The issue is that I care more about the person that I'm speaking to. And that looks different. It looks different because of our understanding of passivity, of gentleness, of meekness. And we tend to say, because we have wrong definitions of those words, we say, you're gentle and you're kind. That means you never say anything that offends if you're loving. If you're loving towards someone, you never say anything that offends them, because that wasn't loving, right? Isn't that what we say when somebody's offended by when someone says something? That wasn't loving. Well, it might not have been. You might not have been dead to yourself. But someone being offended is not the criteria for determining love or words spoken in love. Okay? Because we can be guaranteed that Jesus loved perfectly, offended many. Okay? And we can be very sure of this, the gospel offensive. Okay? To speak the gospel and the truth of the gospel, we will offend. That we are still absolutely, the baseline still is to be loved, is to care, regard others more important than ourselves. Just like our children, okay? Does it seem loving for you to spank your child? Some would say no. You are telling your child you hate him. This is an evil thing. This is a wrong thing to do to your child. You're giving a child the conflict that he doesn't know how to deal with in doing it. Let me just guarantee you, if you do not spank your child, you're hating on him. And spanking your child needs to be, one of the strongest expressions of love towards that child. Love. You're hurting them. You're inflicting pain on them. Why is it love? It's love because you realize that child's right relationship with God is based on him honoring his mother and father. That child's right relationship with God is based on him being obedient to his mother and father. That child's well-being in life is to have a baseline of understanding that submission of his will to his father is a place of peace and joy and security and happiness. And if you do not teach your child that by realizing that there is it's very negative and there are very negative effects to being disobedient to the authority over you, to your father. If you do not do that, the child will grow up in rebellion to the authority over him, including God. Including God. And that's hating. Child, not loving your child. So loving your child does the tough thing. It spanks them, and inflicts pain, even though it is absolutely true. If done correctly, it is far worse and harder on the parent than it is on the child. Okay? Because there's no one that loves your children more than your parent. Okay? And it is extremely difficult to bring yourself to love a child enough to spank them, because you realize that the ultimate best for them is their submission of their will to their father. Submission of their will ultimately to their heavenly father. Ultimately to the authority under them. Remember, we are all under authority. Just choose who's your God. We are all under authority. In spite of this Freedom Day, 4th of July, that we all think we're independent and out from under the authority, and this is just about hedonism and pleasuring ourselves, we're all under authority. Let's keep that. We might not be to a tyrannical king, and we fought against that. Rightfully so, and I'm really grateful for our forefathers of this country for doing that. Okay? And giving us the freedom. Originally, their intention was to give us religious freedom. Freedom to worship God in the way we choose. Not under the command of the king, not dictated by the Church of England, the Anglican Church. That we came here as Puritans who were being persecuted initially to found a country where we could worship God. And to be out from under authority. That was not to be out from under authority. We are never out from under authority. Remember that. All us little rebellious children. We are never out from under authority. We are either under the authority of God or we are under the authority of Satan. That's life. Not independent. We're not free white Americans get to run around and shoot off firecrackers. Okay? That's not the reality of it. Okay? We are under subjection to authority. I'll leave it at that. I hope that by next week that you guys will read 1 Corinthians and think about what it means when Paul says that now I, Paul, myself urge you by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ. What does that mean, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ? Let me just guarantee you that's a very powerful, powerful urging. Nothing about that is passive. And Paul is, I believe, mocking them. I who am meek when face to face with you, but bold towards you when absent. I believe he's mocking what they're saying. Okay? Because that's not Paul. I'm sure Paul was confident of the truth of God enough to be bold when he was present too. Okay? I'm sure that he was not timid and afraid when he was with them. So, I ask you to understand that and to ponder that and meditate on it so that when we talk about that we are to participate in spiritual warfare in the meekness and gentleness of Christ. What does that mean? Those are to be overriding foundational premises for our actions. One is a state of our character, is a state of our being. The other ones is how we respond to people around us. How that comes out and how we deal with that. And those are foundational to engage in the fight that we are in the war that we are in. Okay? Because it says, though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. Tanner writes, pathetic. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience. No. Actions of moral police. Okay? That talking about taking every thought captive. I would ask you to ponder that. Taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And Paul was about that. Felt that was his call from God to be participants in that. And his foundation for that was the meekness and gentleness of Christ that he replicated. So, let's pray. Is a great tool of Satan to mess up our view of you and our view of Jesus. And we've done a good job of that. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I ask you, God, to give us clarity. Because I know you desire. You don't desire us to have a wrong view of you. You don't desire us to have a wrong understanding of Jesus. You desire us to be stirred and troubled the same way the disciples, as we are disciples of Jesus, the disciples of Jesus were troubled and stirred by the statements he made in their response to people. They said, don't you understand? You're really making the Pharisees mad. They were troubled by it. And yet, when the Holy Spirit came, he illuminated truth and it made sense. And they went on to be powerful apostles. Men who spread your gospel and started a foundation of your church in this world. When they understood it. When they understood what you were doing. When they understood the reasons for your character. The reasons for your nature. The reasons for your words. The reasons for your actions and responses to people. So God, we need to do that. So that we can be powerful men and women of you rather than emasculated men and women that live a pathetic religious experience. I don't want to do that. And I honestly don't believe anybody here does either. The key to doing that is to understand you. The key to not being trapped in that bondage and ball and chain of religion is to know your character and your nature, to be submissive to it, and to imitate it. We're called to imitate you, Jesus. And that starts with laying our lives down, giving our lives up. And to be divinely empowered to live our lives. So God, we ask you to please, 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 please clear our view of you up. Clear our view of Jesus up. Cause my brothers and sisters to read and to ponder what the gentleness and meekness of Christ was. Cause them to go. We have a great record of his life, of his character, of his response to people that will describe his meekness and his gentleness in true, accurate understanding. Cause us to go there and see that. God, please, please equip my brothers and sisters and myself to fight the fight, because this is a fight. Cause us to understanding that as we saying, I am free, we are free to serve you. We are free to be bond servants. Our lives given to you as slaves. That's what we're free to do. We're not free to live our lives for ourselves. We're free to be bond servants. God, thank you. Thank you for this foundation of this country. Thank you for the celebration of Independence Day that caused us to be independent from despot, tyrannical kings, from tyrannical church leadership, from a church that was out of control and living in power, living in sin, living in apostasy and heresy. Thank you that we can be free from the dominance and control of that, and that we are free to worship you. We can come here without any negative consequences from our government. Worship you and read your word to us and pray to you and cry out to you and call ourselves little Christ. I thank you for that privilege. Forgive us for taking your grace in vain. And God, don't allow us to take your grace in vain, but to live our lives in a manner that's worthy of you and worthy of our calling. Protect my brothers and sisters today as they go out in this war and this fight and this life. Bless them with the presence, the awareness of your presence, with your glory, with your grace, with your mercy. Amen.